Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Celeste Headlee is off for a few days. With me is Majora Carter, the host of American Public Media's Promised Land and local development strategist for the Majora Carter Group. We're continuing our conversation on that climate change meeting down in Cancun. And first of all, thanks so much for being with us. I know you're sort of headed on a plane off to do something involved keeping the grassroots engines going all over the world.
Well, actually, it's the TED Women Conference in D.C.
Nice. Yeah. That's great. I suspect you'll be talking about this provocative notion that you raised a few minutes ago, and that is you're more interested right now in terms of addressing environmental issues or a variety of issues in teaching people to adapt to climate change, not trying to pull levers to cool the planet down.
Right.
What does that mean?
You know, it's just going to be easier to protect what we already have rather than trying to create a new system. You know, again, you know, there's been government subsidies and all sorts of support for the fossil fuel industry in this country since forever practically. And what we really need, what we know is that climate is affecting all sorts of things around us in terms of, you know, how we do business, in terms of like how our lives are being lived, whether it's in the Gulf Coast and you've got increased flooding because the wetlands there have been destroyed, that natural protection, you know, whether you're in LA and you've got these like alternate cycles of, you know, lots of water and then none at the, at the same time. So how you adapt to that, which is just going to be exacerbated by climate change, and create jobs in the process is actually what's going to make people care about the environment and climate change. Because right now, they don't. I mean, Americans, it's so low on their priority list, it's not even funny.
But if you're talking about cost savings for energy, which takes you into a certain green direction, there may be jobs that come as a result of that. If people start adapting as opposed to buying an insurance policy if they live in a flood zone, suddenly that on a mass scale can affect real estate prices, building decisions, and those could have kinds of green consequences that trickle up.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't see a massive, you know, decline or increase in flood insurance or anything like that in the meantime. But, you know, I do think we need to work on the mitigation aspect because that really is going to help as well. But right now, municipalities are really struggling, you know, with so much that's related to climate change. So working now to figure out where are the jobs associated, what are the industries, you know, that could when you plant lots of trees, you know, urban forestry management, then what you're doing is actually lowering the ambient temperature of a city, so which actually reduces your energy costs.
Right, right.
And those all those jobs are the kind of things that people, you know, with low barriers to entry. So you can train actually some of our most expensive citizens around folks that are generationally impoverished, people that are you're coming back from our oil wars, you know, even folks that were formerly incarcerated.
Coming back from our oil wars, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, well, they are, you know, at an alarming rate, and not coming back. You know,
but these are jobs and professions.
Absolutely.
And development opportunities that are right there.
With career ladders that
exactly.
can go forward as well.
You know, not to get too meta here and, you know, whack me down if I do, but, you know, evolutionary biologists say that the most effective strategies for large-scale shifts in geography or climate is always adaptation, that we are predisposed to biologically adapt to change. That's not to excuse climate change, but it means this is something we're good at.
Precisely. And I see getting people involved in it in ways that affect their bottom line, you know, whether it's their balance sheet or whether it's their bank account or lack thereof, and really helping them see there's their own self-interest in creating a strategy toward climate adaptation, especially now.
So I'm imagining that you have, at least virtually or really, a gigantic photo album of examples on the local level of things that you've done, concrete things, and people who have had this experience.
Yeah.
What picture would you take to Cancun to show one of those 192 leaders?
I would actually go to L.A., which has some issues, in particular water issues, and show them that when the group called Tree People, Andy Lipka started, he was 15 years old, literally convinced the L.A. school district, you know, several years ago, that instead of spending about a tenth of a $2 billion bond issue on adding more concrete to an area, that if they unearth the concrete and added trees, then they could actually reduce air conditioning costs, you know, at the school and actually make the quality of life and deal with stormwater management issues as well, and make the quality of life for kids in that school and better learning experience.
So both are adaptations in the sense that you're making a bigger concrete flood drainage system, whatever.
No, you're removing the concrete to plant
right,
trees.
Right, but if you maintain the existing drainage or do something interesting like plant some trees,
exactly.
They're both adaptations. One's better, though.
Exactly. One actually provides a better learning environment for kids. It provides jobs for people that otherwise wouldn't have it. It lowers the municipalities' energy costs. So those are the kind of beautiful things that I think everyone would find some value in, but they're not necessarily the kind of things when people talk about climate mitigation that gets the kind of props that it should.
You know, you've been talking about these kinds of exciting issues for some time now. I'm wondering if you're growing impatient with the sort of activist environmental world or even the groups of environmental negotiators down in Cancun that don't seem to get this sort of grassroots issue as well as the top-down kinds of stuff.
I am, only because it negates the fact that there are people in our communities all over this country that are dealing with the day-to-day impacts of it, whether it's lack of jobs, you know, whether it's the fact that their communities are used as environmental sacrifice zones. These are real people that I don't think ever really get the kind of attention that they deserve.
Are the Bill Clintons missing this, the Al Gores of the world missing this, or is it more the UN? I mean, I guess, you know, I'm imagining this environmental clique, you know, all sitting around having, you know, drinks on a porch somewhere, thinking they're patting themselves on the back.
And there is some, without naming names, but the reason why it exists is because there is a disconnect with what can actually happen on the ground.
Right.
Like, I've lived and seen how people respond when you give them both financial and practical tools to improving the environment. They understand that it's a better – that it, economically
tools
they also support.
Work. Majora
yes.
Carter, host of American Public Media's Promised Land and local development strategist for the Majora Carter Group. We'll be seeing you a little later this month.
Yes.
Majora, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.